You're listening to Like Mother, Like Son on WJFF.
And that's my mother, Patricia Adams.
And that's my son, Ramsey Adams.
The show is like mother, like son?
Yes. That's right, with
really?
A question mark.
With a question mark?
You know, it's a mother-son thing.
Ramsey, this is more important than anything else coming my way today.
Okay.
To change him. You want to be a richer man. To change him. And face the strain. To change him. It's going to have to be a different man.
You're listening to Like Mother, Like Son on Radio JFF. This is my mother, Patricia Adams.
And that's my son, Ramsey Adams.
We're in the studio with our producer, Mark Sutton.
Joining us today is Kevin Fitzpatrick. And if you've ever heard the expression, men don't make passes at girls who wear glasses, maybe you've wondered who came up with that expression. Well, our guest today is the foremost expert in the world, or at least one of them, on Dorothy Parker. So welcome, Kevin Fitzpatrick.
Thanks, Mark, but I have to correct you right off the bat.
Oh, no.
You misquoted.
I already made
her.
A mistake. We just started.
The correct quote is, men seldom make passes at girls who wear glasses.
Ah, so it's not never, but seldom.
And the name of the poem is News Item.
Oh, well, that's comforting to know that it's
all
only
right.
Seldom since I now wear glasses.
Yes, Patricia's wearing glasses, so
well, now
watch
laser
out.
Eye surgery, it really doesn't matter, does it?
Yeah, does that affect it? Kevin is the founder of the Dorothy Parker Society, and he is also the author of a book,
A Journey into Dorothy Parker's New York. And it's a wonderful book that is both a history of what happened in New York through Prohibition and up through World War II, and even during the era where people were went far to the left and had to appear before the House of American on Activities Committee. And it's also a book of places, theaters, hotels, restaurants that where Dorothy Parker either lived or visited. And so it's a wonderful, complete book that is great to have in hand, and it's the kind of book that you would keep on your shelf and use over and over when you are in New York, because it gives such a wonderful variety of places to visit and
so,
things to see.
So, Kevin, tell us, how did you first get interested in Dorothy Parker?
Actually, it's because we both lived on the same street, West 72nd Street, on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. A friend had given me a biography of Dorothy Parker called What Fresh Hell Is This by Marion Mead, and I really enjoyed it a lot, and I was struck by how she was an Upper West Sider and I was an Upper West Sider. And at the same time, I was looking for a subject to start a website about. I wanted to run my own site. I knew it wanted to be about New York and history and books. And I thought, well, what if I went to all these places that Dorothy Parker, this writer that I really like, lived and worked and drank in? And that's really how DorothyParker.com started, and it's really how my my real devotion to her life and her work started.
Could I ask you a little bit about how you did grow to like the writings of Dorothy Parker? I mean, she was born over 100 years ago, and
mm-hmm.
You're a relatively young man. I mean, I even think of her as somebody in a previous era. But I did grow up hearing her quotes particularly.
Well, she's timeless. I mean, we went to a show last night, and one of her short stories was performed called The Lovely Leave. Now, that was written in 1947. About her World War I and World War II experiences, but just listening to those actors perform it, you couldn't be struck that it could take place of a soldier going off to Iraq, and not a single word would have to be changed.
Oh, that's fascinating. So it wasn't just her wit, but her real sense of
dialogue, of storytelling, of setting a mood, of everything related to her writing and her craft really hasn't gone out of style, and that's really why she's never been out of print.
Well, I found one thing interesting also in looking at your book. You also give a biographical history, and we talk about wits or clowns and tragedy and comedy being just two faces of the same thing. And as you pointed out, she had a very sad childhood. Some very traumatic things happened to her in the first 10 years of her life, or the first 15 years of her life.
Yes, her mother passed away right before she turned 5. Her father remarried the next year, and her stepmother died when she was 9.
Mm.
So she really didn't have a mother figure to speak of growing up. She lived alone with her father and a lot of dogs. And, you know, that's got to be a lonely experience to go through for a kid. And she really didn't have much schooling, you know. By 13, she was done with her formal education.
Right, that's what I read, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, also, I wonder if that had anything to do with the fact that she seemed to prefer the company of men.
Possibly. I never really did too much psychoanalysis of her.
Right.
But, you know, she did grow up, you know, pretty much by herself with her dad, and she was always very, very friendly with the gentleman, as you know.
Right. And she also did write a series of stories or essays about the women I hate.
Yes.
Which are really funny, you know.
But she also wrote about men she hated, too. So
I didn't know that.
She was an equal opportunity offender.
Okay.
All right, Kevin, put this all in context for me. I don't know a whole hell of a lot about Dorothy Parker.
Okay.
Just, you know.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Do you like being in a relationship with somebody?
I'm married, happily married.
Okay. Do you like drinking?
Absolutely.
Okay. Do you like good books?
Good books. That's you know, they have to be good, though. I don't like bad books.
Okay. Well, one of the things she said about a book that she read is that this should not be a book that should be put aside lightly. It should be thrown.
Mm-hmm.
She was a book reviewer. She loved good drama, plays. She was a theater critic, too.
So how did she bust out? I mean, what year did she sort of come onto the scene? Is it the early 20s, the late teens?
Her first published writing was right before World War I. 1915, 1916, and then she really became known during World War I, and then all through the 20s and 30s, she was probably the most quoted woman in America.
And is there some predictability to her, you know, her rise to fame? I mean, if you look at her childhood and her, I mean, is it, she just sort of appear, or is there any kind of, like...
I don't think so. I mean, if you look at the other contemporaries, like Edna St. Vincent Millay, or Eleanor Wiley, you know, other poets of that era. I mean, they were all very different. They didn't have too much in common except, you know, a real zest for life.
Hmm.
I don't know if her fame would be foretold by anything. It certainly was a surprise to her. She always considered just herself kind of a journeyman writer, and she always looked at writing as more of a trade than anything else.
And she was financially successful, too.
Yeah, you know, moderately. I mean, you're not getting rich working on a magazine staff. Her real, she really came into more money when she went to work in Hollywood after silent pictures were taken over by talking pictures. You know, a lot of authors went out to California to make a lot of money. So she was out there when Scott Fitzgerald and William Faulkner and...
Didn't she write the screenplay with her husband for A Star Is Born, the first Star Is Born movie?
Yes, ma'am, you're correct. The very first one, the Janik. And they were nominated for an Oscar for that, too.
Right. And that was with her second husband, I believe.
Alan Campbell.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And that brought them a certain amount of money, I assume.
Well, it was the Depression. And, you know, as she said, the streets were paved with Goldwyn. And
that's great, too.
They were making, you know, what would be in today's money, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 a week.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, that's a lot of money.
Well, although I think, you know, she did write some really interesting things, and that script was quite spectacular, and she wrote the wonderful short story, Big Blonde, which I'd like for you to talk about in a minute. But I do believe people remember her, and even at the time, really think of her witticisms. I mean, I understand that people would follow her around waiting for her to be funny, and that would be terrible pressure on her. I think she once said, people start laughing before I open my mouth sometimes.
Yes, yes, and she it was a real problem for her. I mean, people would say, you know, are you Dorothy Parker? And she said, yes, do you mind? but she also did get, you know, people, you know, following her around and eavesdropping on her, waiting for her to drop, a verbal bomb on them.
Right, right.
You know, after 20 years, that would probably get on your nerves.
I think it'd be a little, as I say, highly pressured to always be expected to, you know,
yes,
to say something funny, witty, and caustic at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to play a song right now that features some lyrics about Dorothy Parker, and I'm sure you know what song I'm talking about.
Let's do.
Cole Porter, I'll give you a hint.
Oh, I love that song. Let It Go.
Okay, so this is Just One of Those Things by Cole Porter.
As Dorothy Parker once said to her boyfriend, fare thee well. As Columbus announced when he knew he was bounced, it was swell, Isabel, swell. As Abelard said to Eloise, don't forget to drop a line to me, please. As Juliet cried in her Romeo's ear, Romeo, why not face the fact, my dear? It was just one just one of those crazy flings, one of those bells that now and then ring, just one of those things. It was just one of those nights, just one of those fabulous flights, a trip to the moon on gossamer wings, just one of those things. If we thought a bit of the end of it when we started painting the town, we'd have been aware that our love affair was too hot not to cool down. So goodbye, dear, and amen. Here's hoping.
And that was Ella Fitzgerald singing Cole Porter's Just One of Those Things.
Could you just talk about Big Blonde briefly? Because I do think many people do have some sense of that story. It's a very sad story, actually. And some people feel it's somewhat autobiographical.
Yes, it is. You're correct. It's a novella. It's her longest short story. She wrote it, and it was published in the Bookman in 1928, and it won the O. Henry Prize in 1929 for the best short story of the year. And it's very autobiographical. It's about Hazel Morse, who's a probably close to 40, you know, used to be good looking, now she's on the other side of her good looks, never really worked very much, and it's very sad. You know, she attempts suicide in the same manner that Mrs. Parker attempted suicide, which is by going over to Hoboken in Jersey City and visiting all the drugstores and collecting a little sleeping tablets from each one until she had a nice little stash and took them back home and swallowed them all at once, but it wasn't enough to do her in, and she just woke up the next day with a big headache.
I think that's part of the lasting appeal of Dorothy Parker, don't you? That that she has this really dark side. She's not all sunny and roses. I mean, she looks at the dark side of life, and I think a lot of people, you know, today still can relate to that. Do you think there's some truth to that?
Yes, because she always had that kind of, you know, devil may care attitude, and you know, she did attempt to kill herself at least 3 times. But the truth is, she outlived just about every other member of the Round Table. So.
Yeah, I want to talk about the Round Table just a little bit, the Algonquin Round Table, which she called the Vicious Circle, right?
Yes.
We don't need to do a whole history of it, but it was this incredible collection of minds and intelligence and mostly critics and magazine writers and editors.
Mm-hmm. Well, it started in June 1919 at the Algonquin Hotel, and you know, the core group was her, Alexander Wolcott from the New York Times, Robert Benchley, Harold Ross, who started the New Yorker. There's really about 24 of them. That's what the next book I'm working on right now is about, all the other people too.
Yeah.
And you know what it was? It was a very different kind of New York. You know, New York had 77 Broadway theaters at the time. Today we have around 30. There were 16 daily newspapers. You know, there was a lot more work for those kinds of writers, actors, editors, mm-hmm. PR people. And they really, you know, got along very well. They collaborated together. And she was, you know, pretty much the one of the few women sitting at the table.
Yeah, I was going to say, there were only, two of them were married to other Algonquin Table people, so I don't know if that's why they got on, but she and Edna Ferber were kind of the two prominent females.
Well, Ferber didn't go there very often because she was such a hard worker. Ferber said she liked to go there on Saturdays and only a few times a year.
Okay.
But there was Jane Grand, who married Harold Ross, and Ruth Hale was married to Haywood Broun.
Right.
Beatrice Kaufman was there with, you know, George S. Kaufman.
Right, but they were married. I mean, she was there as a woman,
yes.
Not as married to somebody there,
right.
Which I think is sort of an interesting aspect,
Kevin,
to it.
Your reviews, which are across the board, people love the book. You really studied this, the life and times and art of Dorothy Parker, but your book isn't a biography of Dorothy Parker. It's a collection of photographs and information, and it's a tour, sort of like a tour of New York City. It's a very interesting premise for a book. How did you come up with that great idea?
Thanks. Well, I actually have to credit a lot to the publisher because it's the first book in the Art Place series, and they're also doing Georgia O'Keeffe's New Mexico and Steinbeck's California. And the thing about the book is you have to understand how Manhattan influenced her and she influenced Manhattan. And so, you know, say you've read every single thing by a writer and you really want to take it to the next level. You want to see the places where they were influenced by. And I really do live this lifestyle. I mean, I'm on my way to Algonquin in about an hour and a half to go have drinks with friends, and I walk all these same streets that she walked and her friends, you know, traveled in. So it really seeped into all the writing of knowing all these places that she went and her friends went, and that now if you're visiting New York, you can go and have a drink in the same place. You can go to these same exact theaters, walk through these same doors that she and her friends did, and I think it's a real kick for some people.
Kevin, do you have a poem by Dorothy Parker that you think is one of your favorites?
I would say Observation. It could have been written yesterday.
And now, Dorothy Parker's Observation, as read by Stephanie Sellers.
Observation. If I don't drive around the park, I'm pretty sure to make my mark. If I'm in bed each night by 10, I may get back my looks again. If I abstain from fun and such, I'll probably amount to much. But I shall stay the way I am, because I do not give a damn.
You're listening to Like Mother, Like Son on Radio Jeff. Our guest today is Kevin Fitzpatrick, author of A Look Into Dorothy Parker's New York.
How did you get Dorothy? I mean, were you surprised when you were able to buy DorothyParker.com?
What happened is, it's actually owned by a nurse, and she and I became friends online, and she had it for about 5 years, and then she wasn't doing anything with it. So I offered to buy it from her and pay for some of her nursing books. And,
a nurse?
Yeah, nurse. Yes.
So really she just happened to be a fan of Dorothy Parker, or her name was Dorothy Parker?
No. She was just a big fan.
So she wasn't trying to start a different website. She just had the name.
Yes, had the name.
Can we ask you how much you paid for the name?
It was in the low three figures.
Okay.
It was about the price of about 25 martinis at the Algonquin. That's how much it cost.
I just want to say one of the best things about this is the Algonquin isn't only still existent. It is very much like it was when Dorothy Parker was there, right?
Yes,
it
is.
It still has that incredible atmosphere, and they still have great music, and it's very much like it was before.
It does. They've recently renovated it, and you know, unlike other hotels that try and take themselves in the 21st century, yes, they have a wireless lobby. Yes, you can, you know, go online at your table. But they also have a little bell on every table to get that waiter over to get you a cocktail as quickly as possible. And they are very friendly. They're very, very warm and gracious. And they really do respect their history. And they let me have my little walking tours in there. And we have parties there all the time, so...
And before we get on, I'm curious to hear some more about the walking tours. I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking today with Kevin Fitzpatrick. He's the author of the book A Journey into Dorothy Parker's New York, and he's also the founder of the Dorothy Parker Society. And if you want to learn more about that, his website is DorothyParker.com. So you mentioned that you do these walking tours. Those start at the Algonquin?
They start and end there, and what's fun is at the end, if you'd like to, we can have lunch at the round table. And what's really fun is, so you spend about 2 hours together with all these people walking around the city. You end up, and people just sit at that table, and it's like they're naturally funny. It's really a powerful thing to have 10 people sitting around a circle enjoying a meal. And, you know, they were strangers 2 hours before, but now they're cracking jokes and telling stories and splitting the checks. And
do you think the $16 martinis help with the...
yes.
You know, I want to read your first paragraph from your book, and I want you to sort of explain what this first paragraph is leading to.
Okay.
It is the autumn of 1988, and Dorothy Parker is back at the Algonquin Hotel, surrounded by reporters. A small crowd is gathered around the round table in the round table room. Some have cocktails in hand, others are telling jokes. A few jot down quips and quotes in narrow reporters' notebooks. Television news cameras are rolling. Somewhere in the room, Mrs. Parker is waiting. She's in a can.
Oh, thank you for reading that. The reason that happened is when she died in 1967, she left her estate to Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. and she named Lillian Hellman as her executrix. So Mrs. Parker was cremated in Westchester, you know, a few days after her funeral. And the funeral, the crematorium called up Lillian Hellman and said, okay, we have these ashes, where do you want them? And she never replied. So a few years later, they were shipped to her attorney, Paul O'Dwyer. And for 15 years, Dorothy Parker's ashes sat in her lawyer's office in a filing cabinet. And it wasn't until 1988 that Marion Mead, Parker's biographer, discovered this. And the remains were turned over to NAACP. And so since 1988, Dorothy Parker has been buried in Baltimore, Maryland, outside the headquarters of the NAACP, which is where her estate rolled over to after Dr. King died.
I want to just say one quote from her that is applicable here. That would be a good thing for them to cut on my tombstone. Wherever she went, including here, it was against her better judgment.
Well, next year is the 40th anniversary of her death, and she's never been in a cemetery. I think that's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Kevin, I must be missing something here. Dorothy Parker, NAACP, what's the deal? She's not African-American, right?
No, she was a very big champion for civil rights and social justice. Her entire life she belonged to left-wing and liberal causes. She was a big champion for racial equality. She wrote an amazing story called Arrangement in Black and White in 1927, which was written after she met Paul Robeson, the amazing African-American singer. And so she left her estate to Dr. King. You know, was very active in 1967. She never met the man, but she believed in what he was doing for civil rights. And she left her estate to him. So ever since then, the copyrights have been controlled by the NAACP.
Now I want to hear something about the celebration of her life and this Parker Fest.
Oh, wow. Well, it's been going on since 1999. It really came about because my website got a lot of traffic, and people said, let's get together. We do a walking tour for her. So the first year I did it, we did the walking tour, then we went to Algonquin, then we went to a speakeasy. And so it's become an annual event, and we have it in the fall. And there's usually a walking tour and a Roaring Twenties party. And this year it's at the Woolworth Building. Every year we have it in a different historic place, and so we're having it at the Woolworth Building as an Art Deco landmark. It's really nice. Yeah, she is credited with saying for the first time a lot of phrases and things like one night stand and what the hell and popped hair.
Also, a lot of people used her little quips. There was an elderly neighbor of ours up here in the Catskills. I mean, this was a woman in her 70s, and she would give this little toast. And I always thought it was Lucy's toast. And it was, as I now know, a famous Dorothy Parker quote, which, here's to the noble martini. I'll have one at the most, two I'm under the table, and three I'm under my host. And I always thought, gee, Lucy is really...
Okay,
that was Dorothy Parker.
I want to do a fact check here. Now, did she get hers right? Because you corrected me on mine.
Well... I'll have to let it slide, Mark, because it's not really written down. It's been written down in several different places, but you're very close. That's
okay.
The gist of it.
Close enough.
Sure.
Okay.
It's one of those urban legends.
Speaking of music, you know, what other music was inspired by Dorothy Parker, or was she passionate about any songs or a certain genre?
Well, she was good friends with George Gershwin, you know. Gershwin performed Rhapsody of Blue at a party she was at before, his public performance. So she was of that era. She knew Gershwin, and you know she met Leonard Bernstein and worked on Candide with him and Lillian Hellman.
She was really involved with the arts community in New York. Totally, it sounds like.
Oh yeah.
That was the Overture to Candide by Leonard Bernstein. We're back with Kevin Fitzpatrick.
And is this a full-time endeavor for you?
Oh, no. No, I work at HarperCollins Publishers. I work as a project manager in the Internet department. And so I'm always doing stuff with books every day. And the Parker stuff is my side project. You know, some people collect stamps or whatever. You know, researching Parker and the Roundtable people is what I do nights, weekends, and holidays.
So is your next project getting the Dorothy Parker Way to replace the Joe DiMaggio Highway?
You heard that. Well, we started a petition campaign in June to rename West 44th Street Dorothy Parker Way.
Great.
And I was prompted because I saw Peter Jennings got one, and Katharine Hepburn got one, and Al Jolson got one this year.
Oh, I have to quote Dorothy Parker again about what she said about about Katharine Hepburn, that she runs the gamut of emotions from A to B.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
That's Avenue A to Avenue B, I guess.
Right.
That was right outside the Al Hirschfeld Theater.
Okay, great.
Kevin, why is Dorothy Parker still popular today?
She's the only member of the Roundtable who's never gone out of print, and I'll tell you why, and that's because she's writing about the human condition. If she's writing a story about getting her heart broken or a bad boyfriend or girlfriend or a lousy mother-in-law, it doesn't matter if that's written in 1926 or 2006, it's not going to go out of style. You know, things that she wrote, you could read today, you don't have to change any words, and, you know, that's timeless.
And I assume by going to your website, we can find out what's going on.
Yes, there's a news section.
Good.
We have, you know, a lot of talks and lectures and get-togethers. I must say, we don't have meetings. We have parties.
That's much more fun.
We don't collect dues. It's open to the public. And I also should say, it's the only organization, the only thing I do that has people of all ages, people in their, you know, teens and 20s up into people that are 70s, and everybody gets along great. The younger people are talking to the older people are talking to younger people and telling them what it was like to go cocktailing in New York in the 40s and 50s. And then the younger people are saying, well, this is what's going on now, and they really get along great. And it's really, really, really neat to do something with people of different generations like that, all because you have a love of New York, a love of this great author. And
sounds like a terrific idea. And as one of the older generation, I'm going to go to your website. I'll be seeing you soon.
Thank you so much.
All right, thanks. Again, we've been talking with Kevin Fitzpatrick. He is the author of A Journey into Dorothy Parker's New York, with a foreword by Marion Mead. That's on Roaring Forties Press. And his website is dorothyparker.com. Thanks for being with us, Kevin.
Thank you so much. I'm so ready for a cocktail right now.
Yeah, I think we're going to go have a martini.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening to Like Mother, Like Son on Radio Jeff. This has been Patricia Adams, Ramsey Adams, and I'm your producer, Mark Sutton. Thanks for tuning in. Check us out next week, 9:30 on Monday night. Visit us online at www.likemotherlikeson.org and let us know what you think of the show.
Good night.